This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're thinking, I should go for a run today, but it looks like it could rain, Sierra says save on epic rain jackets. If you're also thinking, but I can't go out in these beat-up old running shoes, Sierra says save on top brand running shoes. And if you're still thinking, but I'm also busy performing brain surgery, well, then we say, you really should have led with that. Sierra, let's get moving to your local store, like now. Go!
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Hello and welcome to May's episode of Radio Astronomy. I'm Elizabeth Pearson, news editor on Sky at Night magazine, and I'm joined in the studio today by staff writer Ian Todd.
Hello.
And production editor Dave Golder.
Hello.
Coming up later in this episode, we'll be talking to Professor Sanjeev Gupta, a planetary geologist at Imperial College London, who's investigating Mars's geological past using the Curiosity rover. And we'll tell you our top stargazing tip for this month's sky. But now we're going to take a look back at the current issue and what we found out whilst we were putting together the May issue of the magazine. And I actually found out a lot of information that would have been very useful to me about 8 months ago when I did my first ever astronomy travel trip over to the States. This month we've got a big feature about what to take with you when you're going abroad with your telescope and your equipment.
Yeah, I've often wondered, like, you get all these amazing images of, you know, from the Chilean Atacama Desert, and if you really wanted to kind of make a proper use of dark skies like that, you'd really want to bring, you know, a ridiculous scope with you and your DSLR camera and your CCD or whatever, and, you know, a nice mount to track everything. Yeah. But, you know, can you even fit all that stuff on a plane?
The advice you always get given is try and put as much as you can in your hold hand luggage rather than your hold luggage, because then you can keep an eye on it, which is what I did. And then I think that potentially my I couldn't actually lift up my bag over my head, which means I'm not technically supposed to have taken it on the plane. But luckily, somebody very nicely put it in the overhead bin for me.
Yeah, because you were off viewing the
yes.
eclipse.
I went to see the eclipse in August this year, last year.
Where was that?
There was a massive eclipse that went right the way across the US from coast to coast, and I ended up seeing it in the middle of a random field in Nebraska, which was not where I meant to see it, but I had to go sort of running around trying to find the clouds, and so I took, you know, my big camera so that I could take lots of pictures. I took a solar telescope with me, which had to come with a mount and everything like that, and so all of that had to go into my hand luggage so it didn't get damaged, because it's, you know, a sort of like 700-pound piece of telescope. telescope that I didn't want to break. So
you basically took along one pair of knickers then?
Yeah, basically. It's like, just don't look in my hold luggage. There's like nothing there. It's all in my hand luggage. But yeah, so if you are thinking about making a trip to go and take advantage of some dark skies anywhere, or even if it's something that you think you might do at some point in the future, I really recommend picking up, looking at the Have Scope World Travel feature. It was very useful.
Right, well, there's two running themes in this issue, and I think Ian's going to touch on the other running theme, but I am in the Jupiter corner, with Jupiter in opposition in May, and of course that means loads of astronomers will be chasing its moons around. They throw their shadows onto the disk, and they're chasing them at one point, and then they're following them at another point, and everybody gets very excited and moon spotting up there. I got more excited though about all the JunoCam stuff that's been coming out, because you've got a massive feature on the Juno mission and how it's turned Jupiter into a media star. It's now literally a superstar, even though it's a planet.
Yeah, I've always been amazed, like with the moon stuff, I've always been amazed that you can see the shadow of a moon on another planet. That just blows my mind, the fact that we can do that. But also all these Juno images that have been coming in, because we're so used to seeing Jupiter from the side on. And most of these pictures are coming from above or from really weird angles. And it's so weird to kind of see this planet that you thought you knew from a completely different perspective.
That's right, yeah, because it's such an iconic planet that you're used to seeing, you know, the bands and the great red spot. But because of the polar orbit of the Juno spacecraft, yeah, as you say, it's all kind of clouds and polar storms and things like that. But like as the feature points out, we've learned so much about the storms and the aurora and the magnetic field of the planet just through this mission.
Yeah, it's amazing. From a scientific level, I mean, so much is being learned that we never didn't know and didn't even think about with in terms of Jupiter. So it's actually changing what scientists think of the planet. There's loads of new stuff out there to discover. But then also the public are getting on board, and it's like a great PR campaign for the planet, you know, because with JunoCam, it's like basically making all the pictures that JunoCam is sending back available to the public to process themselves. And it's like, what do you come up, you know, what are they coming up with? And they're coming up with some brilliant stuff and some balmy stuff, some crazy stuff, but it's great. There's about 210 pages of it now on the site, and I was just going to say it's a bit weird talking about stuff like this in a podcast, because nobody can see the images. So I'm going to show you a couple of random images to these two, and they've got to say exactly what the first thing that comes into their mind. So what's that?
It looks like sound waves or something weird like that, or like ripples in a pond.
To me, it looks like, you know, when you watch The Blue Planet and they go right down to the bottom of the sea where no light can get. It looks like some kind of like luminescent swordfish.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
I was thinking Blue Planet quite a lot with these as well.
Yeah.
Hang on. Here's another one.
It's purple. Why is Jupiter purple?
That's what JunoCam achieves.
It looks really shiny, which is weird because it's made of gas.
It looks like maybe if you mixed red wine and milk in a bowl and it all curdled.
Oh, that sounds horrible.
We could go on all day. Let me pick one more of the more extreme ones. Hang on. They're classic.
That looks like the personification, the sort of imagization of my opinion of the 60s. That is properly psychedelic.
Yeah, it looks like an infrared image of a bird's eye.
Yeah, I can see that. Or like one of those, you know, sort of when they like showing like people doing like in a petri dish with cells and things.
Yeah.
Kind of looks like one of those.
I can see that. Anyway, if you're wondering what the hell we're talking about, you need to pick up our latest issue, because we got a great little gallery of images in there from JunoCam. And also in our issue 146 last year, the July issue, I think it was last year, we had another JunoCam gallery. So you could order that through back issues if you wanted, or try and pick it up somewhere. And if you want to check online, you need to go to www.missionjuno.swri.edu/JunoCam. I hope you're taking notes, so that took me ages to get it right.
So it's a bit of a Jupiter special this issue, but also a bit of a Mars special, and as part of the bonus content, to kind of tie in with Ezzy's feature this month, which is about the InSight mission, which is this new mission mission to Mars. I've been speaking to Bruce Bannert, the principal investigator of the InSight mission, so you can watch the video interview on our bonus content. But the InSight mission is really interesting because usually when we think of missions to Mars, we think of maybe perhaps the orbiters that kind of analyze gases in the atmosphere, or the rovers that kind of look at the Martian geology. So it's kind of the atmosphere or the surface of Mars. But this InSight mission is going to actually be drilling down deep below the surface. And it's kind of been described as NASA as taking Mars's pulse and temperature. So it's going to do things like measure the seismic vibrations, which are called Mars quakes. I love that. I love the fact that maybe as we discover more quakes on different planets, we'll have more quakes. So like Io quakes or
Venus
quakes or whatever.
That's great.
And this will help it work out the thickness and densities of the layers before below Mars's surface. And one of the instruments is called the Heat Flow and Physical Properties Probe, or HP3, and it's going to hammer up to 5 meters into the ground and measure heat flowing out of the planet, and this will hopefully reveal why when Mars was forming it cooled very shortly after formation, whereas Earth didn't. So kind of showing basically learning more about the formation of rocky planets. But yeah, it was kind of ultimately to tie in with your feature, Ez.
Yeah, it was one of those things that because everybody, when you think of missions to Mars, you're thinking, it tends to, and I hate to use this word, you think of the sexy missions, the rovers. But actually, InSight is going to sit in the same place. It's going to be incredibly still. And it will be able to tell us about the entire planet. So even though these rovers are going all over the place, InSight will be looking at more of it, at more of the, technically it's not the Mars's geology, it's the aerology, I think is how you pronounce it, because geo means Earth and Aries means Mars, but nobody calls it that because it's confusing. So we've got Mars quakes instead of earthquakes, but we've got geology, not aerology, because we're scientists and people like to be confusing when you're naming things.
The other really interesting thing that kind of grabbed my attention about this mission is we're always hearing about whenever a new exoplanet is discovered, one of the ways you can kind of work out what sort of a planet it is, if you can't see it, very clearly, is you can observe how it wobbles as it's orbiting its host star, and this can tell you about the density and whether or not it's got a molten core and things like that. But they're going to do that on Mars, but obviously they'll actually have a rover, but they'll actually have the InSight spacecraft will actually be on Mars, and it's going to because they've got the precise location of where it is on the planet, they can precisely measure Mars's wobble as it orbits the sun, and this will tell us more about kind of its internal density.
Yeah, the analogy that I got told was it's like if you spin a hard-boiled egg and a raw egg, the raw egg wobbles more, and it's kind of the more liquid you have inside, the more stuff wobbles.
Ah, nice. I like that one. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's just crystallised it all for me now.
But yeah, speaking of Martian geology, in this week's interview, I spoke to Sanjeev Gupta, who is a geology professor at Imperial College London and a member of NASA's Curiosity mission on Mars. And regular viewers of The Sky at Night will recognise Professor Gupta from the April episode. And I started off by asking Professor Gupta exactly what the Curiosity rover is doing on the Red Planet and what we can learn from studying Martian rocks.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Listen closely. As a master painter carefully brushes Benjamin Moore Regal Select down the seam of the wall. It's like poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs and the small dogs who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
The first task of this rover is really trying to work out whether Mars might have had the conditions suitable for life in its ancient past. So it's, in some ways, it's previous Mars missions were searching for water. And what this rover is doing is trying to find out whether ancient Mars had conditions that might have been habitable for ancient microbial life. So in some ways, it's a stepping stone to the discovery of life. Of course, we'd gladly be happy to discover evidence for life, but that's quite a difficult task. And so our first task is, are the right rocks and are the right environmental conditions present on ancient Mars where we're searching to look for life, or are we wasting our time looking at Mars?
So what sort of instruments does it have? And also, what's its kind of day-to-day routine? What does it actually look for, and what's it actually analysing?
Okay, so we have a huge host of instruments on board the rover. It really is a mobile laboratory, looking at a variety of different things. So firstly, there's all the engineering instruments on board, because without the engineering stuff, we wouldn't be able to do science. So there's a lot of engineering cameras on board the rover. There's hazard cameras, two hazard cameras, both on the front and the rear. And we have these navigation cameras on the mast of the rover, and these produce stereo images, the navigation cameras. We produce a stereo mesh, so a digital elevation model of the landscape in front of us. And this is what the rover drivers, called the rover planners, actually use to produce a pathway to drive, basically, on the surface of Mars. And this is probably the most important instruments, if you like. The rover itself is powered by a plutonium battery, powered by radioactivity. And then there's a whole host of science instruments. So firstly, we have all the cameras on board. The geology cameras are what we use to characterize the geology of the rover. These are stereo cameras, again, on the mast. They take color images. And at the end of the arm, we also have a hand lens camera that can take close-up images of the rock so we can get the detailed texture of the rocks, etc. And then we have all these instruments that can characterize the chemistry of the rocks that we encounter and the soils that we encounter. So firstly, we have a laser, again, on top of the mast that can shoot a laser beam about 7 meters. What it does, it produces a plasma in the rocks, and then there's spectrometers in the mast and ChemCam that can actually look at the elemental chemistry. So it's semi-quantitative, and it's kind of a survey instrument trying to see if, what sort of the approximate chemistry of the rocks are. And then we have a bunch of other instruments that can basically look at the more detailed chemistry. And then probably the two most, the game changers as far as this rover is concerned, as this is entirely new for Mars, is that at the end of the arm, we have a whole bit of kit that we can drill into the surface of Mars. And this is entirely new, never drilled on another rocky body elsewhere away from Earth. Obviously, on the moon, we collected samples that astronauts brought back. Can't do that on Mars yet. And so we drill a sample up to 7 centimeters deep into the Martian surface. And there's a whole sample handling facility that takes the rock powder. And that rock powder is then transferred to two major instruments. One is ChemIN, which is X-ray diffraction, and this gives us true mineralogy of the Martian rocks. And prior to this, other instruments give us the elemental composition, but we kind of have to work out what the possible minerals to make up that elemental composition would have been. Here, this we get true mineralogy, and again, this is really important because it's quite difficult to do it from just the elemental composition. And the other instrument is a huge box called SAM, Sample Analysis of Mars, and this is just an incredible instrument. And what it does is it's a set of three mass spectrometers. It's doing different things. Some of it's actually looking for methane in the Martian atmosphere and measuring other gases in the Martian atmosphere. But the key instrument in this mass spectrometer in this is basically takes the rock powder, it puts it into crucibles and heats the rock powder up to very, very high temperatures. And that vapor that's given off is then taken off by a helium stream and analyzed in the mass spectrometers, in the GCMS, etc., gas chromatography, etc. And we're looking for the composition of these gases, which is telling us about something about the chemical composition of the rocks. And of course, obviously, what we're after is complex organic compounds in the rocks that we're analyzing.
I mean, it's really interesting because you're obviously collecting all this data, and it obviously has to be analyzed by humans. But you're obviously using the same techniques, I presume, that you would use on Earth. So I was just wondering how transferable the kind of Earth-centric geology is to Mars. How similar is the Martian terrain to Earth?
Well, it looks very similar. I've worked a lot as a geologist in desert regions around the world, in Egypt and the Western US, and apart from the signs of vegetation that you still get in deserts, it looks very, very similar. So the rock types and the arid environment make it look very similar, and also a lot of the techniques we're using are very, very similar. So the hand lens camera, I mean, when I'm in the field, I permanently have attached around my neck a hand lens. Actually, lots of geologists wear theirs all the time, but not me. probably the one key geological tool that we don't have that would actually be a game changer for us, but would be very difficult to do on Mars, is that geologists rely very heavily on being able to make sections of a rock and being able to look at those sections, wafer thin, and look at them through microscopes. And obviously, we don't have that capability. And so it actually limits our ability to interpret Martian rocks because of that capability. So we have this fantastic geochemistry analysis we can do, but some of the key details that we need to know about rocks come from textures that you can only observe down a microscope. And we can't do that. And this is basically a bit of fundamental geology that we've been able to do on Earth for, over 100 years, and we can't do this on Mars yet.
Yes, presumably the entire job would be a lot easier if we could actually send human geologists to Mars.
Oh, yes, it would be really very easy. Firstly, obviously, we can't do real-time geology on Mars. So, it takes 14 minutes for a signal to go to Mars and come back. So obviously we don't do real-time geology. What we do is we upload a whole day of commands that are then carried out on Mars. And obviously this limits what we can do. It's a little bit slower. And again, a rover, it's pretty nimble, Curiosity, but it's not as nimble as what a geologist would be like. And there's many places the rover can't actually get up to. It can't skirt around boulders to get to a cliff face or climb up. So, at the moment, that's all we can do. But I envisage a day that, geologists would actually go to Mars, astrogeologists would go to Mars and map the terrain, be able to make immediate decisions on what samples to collect, etc.
Yes, it would be great if it could happen within our lifetime, at least. But that's not, I suppose, to detract from all the things that we have learnt via rovers like Curiosity. And one of the major things that humans have discovered about Mars is the fact that water once flowed. We found like riverbeds. I mean, that must have been a complete mind-blowing discovery at the time.
Strangely enough, we encountered these rocks, and I absolutely remember the day the images came down. We're looking at them. Yeah, wow, look, we can see these rounded pebbles, and we're kind of like, oh, that's cool, that's great. And it took a few days for us to really dawn how significant this was, because this was, the first. I mean, obviously, we had all this orbital imagery that clearly suggested that there must have been, flows of water on the surface of Mars, but it's orbital imagery, it's not something you can touch. And then we saw these pebble beds with beautiful rounded pebbles that can't be moved by wind blown activity, etc. So we saw these, and it took a while for it to sink in that actually this was the first in situ evidence for water flow on the surface of Mars. And it was interesting because when we wrote the paper, I think the reviewers said that we were being very conservative in our interpretations. And that's not normally the case with papers. Papers, you probably usually big it up a little bit, but we're being very careful and not overselling it. And people basically, the reviewers kind of said, well, actually, this is a pretty significant discovery.
do you think that if there ever was life on Mars at some stage in its history, Is there a chance that all evidence of that could be wiped out? Is there a chance that life may have existed on Mars, but the passage of time has simply gotten rid of all the potential evidence?
So that's a really important point that people often don't realize. There's this idea that somehow if we don't find life, that's it. It never existed. But actually, you know, we're looking at rocks that are older than rocks that we can find preserved on Earth. And when we look at the earliest evidence for life on Earth, it's actually often pretty controversial. You know, you see these bits of, you know, evidence, either chemical signatures or sort of morphological signatures in rocks, and there's always arguments. You know, people will publish a paper and then people will say, no, that's rubbish, you can't say that, etc. So it's not an easy task. And the big problem is that whilst early Earth and early Mars may have been teeming with life, it may not have been preserved, particularly with Mars, because it hasn't had an atmosphere. It's been bombarded by radiation. The problem is that radiation may have damaged any organic matter preserved in those rocks. And that's one reason why we've got two major rover missions to Mars upcoming. The big one for us in Britain is the ExoMars mission, ExoMars rover mission, that's launching in 2020, landing in 2021. And that's actually going to have a drill that's going to drill significantly deeper into the surface of Mars, they say up to 2 meters. And the reason for that is that it's going to go deeper than the radiation damage zone. So, you know, Curiosity drills up to 6 or 7 centimeters, but that's still within the radiation damage zone. And these rocks at the surface have been, you know, exposed to radiation for billions of years. So if we can get that deep into the Martian surface, we may encounter rocks where the organics may have been preserved, not been damaged by radiation, so we have a better chance of discovering evidence for life, past life.
Incredible. And in terms of Curiosity, it's just passed a pretty big milestone. But what's next for the future of Curiosity? Is there a timeline for when the mission is going to end? And is it going to be doing anything significantly different?
So actually, we're just getting to the most exciting part of the mission. We're actually getting to the place where we always intended to get to. And it's taken us a long time, partly because we've discovered exciting geology on the way, which has provided the context. So that's really important for us, is that it's great if you discover, you know, imagine you discovered rocks with life in them or evidence for ancient life. Without the context, you can't explain it. So the key bit of what we do, and particularly my task, is reconstructing the paleoenvironmental context. So we've had a long drive, partly through that, and partly through, obviously, we have, as all missions have issues, etc. We're slowed down. We don't know the terrain. The terrain's been rough, and we're just getting to this place where we see this abundant signature of clay minerals in the rocks. Clay minerals are hydrated minerals, which indicate interaction of water with rock. And we just don't know what the ancient environment of these clay minerals was like. And then we see an abrupt transition into rocks with a very distinct sulfate signature. And again, we don't know what these environments were like. They might have been drying lakes, and we have no idea. And so it's really exciting for us to be able to reconstruct that. And, you know, the exciting thing is that from a long distance, you can't tell. You have to get up close to these rocks to be able to look at them and reconstruct, work out what that ancient environment looked like, what that landscape looked like, and paint that picture of the landscape. And so from here, from our current vantage point, we can kind of see these rocks and the excitement's ahead of us, but we don't know what the answer is.
It sounds like there's plenty more to discover on Mars, and we look forward very much to finding what you and your colleagues discover. But Professor Gupta, thanks very much for speaking to me today.
Thank you very much indeed.
That was Professor Sanjeev Gupta. Find out more about how the geology of Mars is uncovering the planet's mysterious past in the May issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine.
There's lots to see in the night sky this month, which you can find out all about in our Sky Guide in this month's issue. But if there's one thing you should really see in May, it's Jupiter, the king of planets, which is visible in the early evening twilight as the brightest object low down in the southeast. It stays visible right through the night, getting higher in the sky, and even a small telescope will show you its four largest moons, which are really a surprising and captivating sight.
So that's it from us this month. You can find out more about which of Jupiter's moon is which in the May issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine, where we also preview NASA's InSight mission to investigate Mars's interior, remember the remarkable life of Stephen Hawking,
take a look at the momentous discoveries the Juno mission is making around Jupiter, and not forgetting our regular sections that will help you unlock the wonders of the night sky, find the right equipment to observe it with, and discover the best things to see after dark this month. From all of us here at BBC Sky at Night magazine, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Fletcher. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or simply head to iTunes.